officially welcome everyone to today's Kulin seminar. Again, it's either good morning or good afternoon, depending on which part of the country you're joining us from. I'd like to welcome everyone to today's internet seminar on, or part of, the NARPM Presents series, which will in particular today focus on using science to find solutions at Superfund sites. And it'll explore the benefit of EPA and USGS collaboration. This seminar series has been sponsored by the EPA Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. My name is Jean Balance, and I'm working with EPA as part of that same office. I'll be helping to moderate today's Kulin seminar. And we'll begin the formal presentation in just a minute, but while I'm waiting for a few other people to join us, I'm going to cover a couple of basic housekeeping items and reminders in terms of how today's seminar will work. If you haven't done so already, I would ask you to get a copy of the presentation materials open and available to you. When you registered for today's seminar, you would have been directed to a seminar homepage, which had a complete description, date, time, contact information for all of our instructors, as well as myself. It also included links to download the PowerPoint presentation or PDF file. And there's also an option to actually go to the seminar to check in online and look at the slides through a web browser window. So I want to be sure that everybody has a copy of the presentation materials open, and we are all starting on slide number one. I'm going to direct everyone to move along to slide number two, and if you haven't figured it out or haven't joined us before, Kulin Internet seminars will function very similar to a conference call. Each individual participant will be expected to manually move through the materials based on verbal cues from our presenters today. So I'm on slide number two, the housekeeping slide. As I mentioned earlier, we have placed all the phone lines on a global mute, so I would ask everyone to remain muted until we get to breaks for Q&A. And at that point, when we have a break for Q&A, I will remind you on how you can unmute your line so that you can ask the question out loud. We will have a break scheduled partway through of the presentation today, and then we'll also have more time at the end of the formal presentation to take your questions. So again, I would ask you to stay on mute. If you do need to disconnect for any reason, you're welcome to do so. There will be no tones. You can certainly hang up and then join back in on the phone line at any time. Those of you that are streaming the audio, though, won't have to actually ask the questions out loud. Instead, as you move through the materials, you'll have a few options to interact. You'll see that there are numbered links that appear on the left-hand side of the slides through a web browser window view. You can use the numbered links to jump through to the slides. Again, we're on slide number two. You can also use the icons that are located at the top of the slide. There are a bunch of orange buttons. The one with a single arrow pointing to the right will move you forward one slide. The single arrow to the left will move you backwards one slide. If you look at the question mark icon, which appears more to the right, as long as your pop-up blockers have been disabled, if you click that button with a question mark in it, a new window will open up, and it will give you the opportunity to actually type up an electronic question or comment. You can also use that very same form to submit any technical problems that you may experience. We would ask if you have technical problems to include a telephone number where you can be reached so that our support staff can help troubleshoot your issues. I would also encourage you, if you can, to submit your questions in advance. You don't need to hold electronic questions until those breaks. You can actually type them up at any point in time during the presentation, and then I'll hang on to them until we get to the designated times for Q&A. And at that point, I'll read the questions out loud on your behalf so that our presenters may answer them. Another reminder for today's session, when we are all done, I will provide links to a website where you can download the presentation materials as well as other items that have been collected for the NARPM Present series. And there will also be a link to our short feedback form. If you're interested in receiving credits or trying to document your participation today, you'll want to hang tight and learn more about how to submit feedback so you can get a confirmation email for your own records. And the last reminder I have for everyone today is that today's session is being recorded, and an archive will be made available in about 1 to 2 weeks through the Kulin website. You will all automatically receive an email as soon as that archived version is available, and you're welcome to either download, replay, or forward the archived version on to a colleague that you think it will be helpful. So with that, I think those are the end of the reminders that I have for today's session. And I'm going to move everybody on to slide number three. And again, today's session is a two-hour webinar that will be led by two EPA Region 4 Remedial Project Managers, or RPMs, within the Superfund Division, a Superfund Remedial Branch, and a Research Hydrologist with the USGS. They will provide an overview of the various science-based approaches used from 2008 through 2012 at the Capital City Plume, or CCP, Superfund site that characterized a chlorinated solvent and metals-contaminated groundwater. The webinar will cover the investigation of potential contaminant source areas, contaminant pathways, and then probable contaminant release histories. The same science-based approaches that were successfully used at the CCP site also can be used at other similar Superfund sites for potentially responsible party assessment is not as straightforward. So with that, I'm going to turn things over to our first presenter today on slide number 3, and that will be Scott Miller from EPA Region 4.
Good afternoon and good morning. Welcome. We're here today to talk about using science to find solutions at Superfund sites and the benefit of EPA and USGS collaboration. We're on slide 3 and going to slide 4. I, along with Rusty Kessel, are both remedial project managers based in Atlanta, Georgia, at EPA Region 4. In addition today, Dr. Jim Landmeyer, we're moving to slide 5 now, with the South Carolina United States Geological Survey Water Science Center, will also be one of the presenters today. Moving to slide 5. 6, rather. One of the challenging things, there are many challenging things about being a remedial project manager, EPA or state remedial project manager at Superfund sites. One of those things is that a lot of the low-hanging fruit has been picked. And by that we mean that things that are easy get done quickly and things that are more complex or require much more science to be applied take a longer time. And certainly at this site, the site has been around for a good period of time, we would say since 2000, so it's creeping up on teenager status, as we like to call it, and we don't want it to be sent to college without a remedial action in place. So some of the questions that we have to answer out there, and we have been answering in collaboration with the USGS, are who are the responsible parties that create at site contamination? Are there potential vapor intrusion issues? We received some complaints, employee complaints from a building that was formerly used as a printing operation there, and we had to get in an expedited fashion and address the possibility that vapor intrusion was taking place at a building, and if so, if that vapor intrusion was posing an unacceptable risk to the building inhabitants. Also, the more complex the site is, the more likely the conceptual site model is complex. And so it needs additional attention paid to it. And one of the many benefits of USGS and EPA collaboration is going to be demonstrated with a specific case study today at the Capital City Plume. But those benefits include an objective scientific approach that the survey takes in approaching projects that they have, not only with the EPA, but throughout the nation, use of multiple lines of evidence to draw conclusions, large sets of data, an extensive internal peer review process that guarantees a quality output. In just a second, I'm going to turn this over to Dr. Jim Landmeyer with the USGS to talk about specifics of this study. Dr. Landmeyer has been a research hydrologist with the USGS South Carolina Water Science in Columbia, South Carolina since 1990. Dr. Landmeyer received his BS from Allegheny College in 1989 and his MS and PhD from the University of South Carolina in 1991 and 95 respectively. He has been co-author of more than 70 peer-reviewed publications, and in 2011 authored the textbook, Introduction to Phytoremediation of Contaminated Groundwater. His research interests include the interaction between plants, microbes, and pristine and contaminated groundwater and surface water systems. Another important aspect of remediation that Dr. Landmeyer has been involved with is the design and implementation of remedial actions throughout the United States, and a very hands-on approach. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Jim to get more into the specifics of this case study to show the benefits of collaboration between the EPA and USGS to areas of scientific inquiry at Superfund sites. Jim?
Thanks so much, Scott. Let's move on to, I guess, slide 7. And this is sort of the point of entry where the USGS, the water mission area aspect of USGS, got into this particular site with the EPA, and it went back to 2008. And this is probably something that you know, multiple RPMs who might be listening in today, if they think about some of the sites that they had that or are currently working on, the contaminant itself might be different. But I think the symptom might be the same. In this particular case, at the Capital City plume site, which is our case study for today's presentation, is the question that EPA, specifically Scott, wanted to have answered was why were PCE, this is perchloroethylene, and TCE, trichloroethylene, why were these widely used solvent concentrations that had been detected in groundwater at that particular site, like Scott mentioned, as long ago as 1999 or 1991, why were these concentrations not going down after almost 20 years? So let's advance to slide 8. This is a busy slide, but it's an important slide. It had all, you know, had been almost 2 decades since the initial detection of PCE, and this is the top part of, this is actually a table from a report that we wrote about a year ago documenting all the work we've done at the site. In fact, I want to bring up that I know you all have the opportunity to download this slideshow, okay, and I hope you do so. But I also want to make, and I'll remind you all at the end of the presentation, or Scott will, that you can easily get the report that we published. It's a peer-reviewed USGS report. It's going to the USGS website and searching on just Capital City Plume, and you'll find it. Just download it as a PDF. This table is actually from that PDF. In fact, probably 90% of what we're going to talk about today is contained in that report. So have no fear if we go through too quickly, if you forget something, and it comes time, you know, that this thing is over, you'll be able to look at that report at your leisure if you can find it. So in any case, the first line up there shows in 1991, PCE was detected. I'm not going to walk through every single thing here, just hit some highlights. But PCE was detected, and this is important, in a public supply well. It's a shallow well, less than 100 feet deep, and, you know, very susceptible in that particular vertical situation. But it was a public supply well in a sole source aquifer for a major, in this case, a capital city of a major southeastern state. So not a trivial thing. And it was detected, and this is sort of a tip to the EPA, it was detected in 91 based on EPA's mandate for municipal water providers to do, if you remember that long ago, a wellhead protection program or plan. And as part of that plan, around the country, folks had to consider the option of sampling their municipal water for things they may not have even heard of, or even their lab that they would send water samples to, and one of those things was PCE. So PCE popped up at a level, in this case, above the federal MCL in 91. Now, what this means is that probably that's not the first time, even though that was the first sample taken, that was probably not the first time that that well actually had experienced PCE. In fact, as we go through this presentation, I think it'll become quite obvious that probably when that well was installed in the mid-60s, there was also PCE at that location at that time. It just, they weren't sampled. And that's a particularly important part to keep in mind here. The second thing is that, so that's one exposure, okay, or potential route of exposure. It's in a drinking water well. Actually, that well was shut down, as was a sister well. Then, as you move down a couple of bars to September of 1993, there was actually a acute exposure to what turned out to be PCE, TCE vapors as workers were constructing a footing or a foundation for one of the buildings in downtown Montgomery. And we'll show the location of where this building is in a couple of slides down, but the thing to keep in mind here, and again, this is part of going back, and when you look at a site like, in this case, it had 20 years or so of history, or maybe sites that you all are investigating yourselves, it's useful to go back and do kind of a stepwise search on what previous information, what folks had already shown. And a lot can be learned from that. In this particular case, the exposure was not as they were digging near land surface. They were actually had to get down to 25 feet. And then they were encountering exposure with vapes. In fact, the folks were even sent to a hospital. And it's important because at that location, the water table is about, the mean water table is about 30 feet. So this is an instance where just the raw data from the exposure would suggest that whatever was there was at there at depth. It was not something that was released at that site from land surface down. And then more to the point as far as how EPA got involved in 1996, it's about halfway through that table. The state, in this case, Alabama Department of Environmental Management, requested assistance from EPA. And I think Rusty Kessel is one of the co-instructors today. And I think, Rusty, if you're there, you might want to give some of your insight because you were pivotal at that time in recognizing that even though it looked like a localized issue, that it probably had implications for the larger groundwater basin underneath the city. And Rusty, are you there?
Yes, Jim, I'm here. Yes, my name is Rusty Kessel. I'm currently a remedial project manager with Region 4 of EPA out of Atlanta, Georgia. But back in 1993, I was a geologist with the hydrogeology unit of the Alabama Department of Environmental Management, and I lived and worked in Montgomery, Alabama, where this site is located downtown. And we were just, you know, blocks away, you know, from this location. So I remember back in 93 when I was working in Montgomery for the state of Alabama, going down there and seeing this excavation when this was occurring, when those workers were overcome by the vapors. And like Jim said, there's a map. It's on slide 11. And the grid that's labeled 31, about half of that grid was opened up, and it was, you know, all the way down to 30 or 40 feet in the deepest part of the excavation, you know, almost down to groundwater. It was in the Nevado zone. So these were vapors that, you know, looked like they were, you know, probably coming up from depth. And at the time, you know, we were kind of stumped as to what was going on because, you know, we didn't know of any releases in that area. We didn't have any history of the releases in that area that, you know, we looked for the usual suspects. We walked, I remember, this is like, you know, back in 1993, it's almost 20 years ago, but I remember walking around downtown Montgomery, you know, looking for things like dry cleaning operations and, not really seeing, you know, anything like an ongoing release at that time. And I ended up moving from, Alabama to Georgia in 1995, and that's the last I worked on the site. You know, wasn't even known as the Capital City Plume. But when I left in 95, it was, you know, they went ahead and built the building. They covered up, you know, they over-excavated some of the contaminated soil. I think they had to, you know, the construction contractors that built the building had to, you know, do some redesign work. But they went ahead and built the building and covered up that window that we had opened up into this groundwater contamination. And then in 95, like I said, I moved to Georgia, and I didn't hear about this site anymore until 2008 when I became a remedial project manager and ended up having the cube right next to Scott Miller, who was the remedial project manager for this Capital City Plume. And I told him I, you know, I had experience with this when initial discovery, and then this was at the same time that, you know, Dr. Jim Landmeyer was getting involved also. So I've been on several of the site visits and just, you know, kind of comparing notes to how things are, we're doing it today than how we were doing it back then. It's just, you know, a matter of perspective. When you first, you know, look at something like this, you look at a problem like this and try to solve it, you know, it's just, you know, having to look and try to see all your resources that are available. And Scott Miller has done a great job of getting a great resource in Jim Landmeyer. And I just wanted to, you know, let him know from my perspective, you know, as a state regulator and then now as also the federal, you know, project manager, you know, how those two kind of experiences work together, and my perspective on, you know, we just had this one limited, you know, window on the plume, and we were kind of, you know, because it was a downtown area, it was all very heavily developed, we couldn't really do a whole lot of investigation, you know, traditional investigation work, you know, over-excavating or putting in a lot of monitoring wells or that kind of thing. Just, there was just too many, you know, roads and buildings and utilities in the way. So with that, I'll just turn it back over to Dr. Jim.
All right. Thanks, Rusty. Really appreciate that perspective. And just moving quickly through the rest of this slide, just some highlights again. In 96, we just talked about the request from the state to the EPA, and then basically the paperwork flow started. The remedial investigation was initiated by the EPA in 2000. Wells went in, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, when we looked at the last groundwater sampling event that had been conducted in 2007 by the city of Montgomery at EPA's request, it was still back to that same question that Scott hinged on, was why were things not changing? In fact, it's interesting when you release or there are PCE chlorinated solvents in groundwater, in many cases, if you know something about the redox history, that basically means either the groundwater is aerobic, there's oxygen, or it's anaerobic, the oxygen is not there. And particularly at this case, at this site, it's a sandy terrestrial terrace type aquifer system along an old floodplain, you have good porous sands, therefore you have a lot of recharge, you have a lot of dissolved oxygen. So one of the reasons that the PCE and TC had stayed there was simply because there was no natural attenuation from, say, biodegradation or dechlorination. It's an aerobic aquifer, the worst place, as it turns out, to have a release of these chlorinated solvents. Next thing, too, is that stable plume tends to suggest it's been an older release. Conditions are at steady state, where you might have a residual source, but the removal of solute from that source down gradient with the groundwater flow system is balanced by things like advection dispersion, or you have some combination of that. So let's move on to slide 9. And just, you know, Scott did a great job, and my hat's off to you there, in sort of giving a little bit of background about the USGS. But the great thing about the USGS as far as what we can offer, and not just myself, obviously, but, you know, we have an office in every 50 states of the union, and we even work internationally. One of the great things about the USGS, it is a Department of the Interior Bureau. It's a science organization. And what I mean by that on slide 9 is we have no regulatory or land management responsibilities. So there's nobody telling us to get a particular answer for any particular management group. So the data we have is impartial, and it's peer-reviewed internally, almost sometimes where it has given us a bad name and we get our product out a little bit later than we would like, but at the same time, it's a very highly reviewed product. And helping other sister agencies is what is part of our mission. In fact, towards the end, Scott will bring up a couple of examples where not just that we have been working together, but there's some other good examples around the country. So let's move on to slide 10. This is a common problem. Not only was at many Superfund sites, not only at this particular site was this long history of just the contamination being there, but nobody knew really definitively where the contamination was coming from, either one source, multiple sources, the time series release, etc. And that was sort of our biggest task. And one of the things I want to make sure I stress here is that, you know, we're going to be showing what we did specifically at this specific site. However, these are really, in some cases, are really off-the-shelf type approaches. Obviously, it's how well you can motivate these to be done in the field. But these are things that, you know, they're not just available to us. They're available to anybody who can work through them. So keep thinking about, as we're showing this, think of your own sites, if they could be used there. All right. We showed that pretty picture as our introductory slide. It's a capital city. Maybe in the back you remember they were up on the hill with the capital city. The city is also has a lot of percent impervious surfaces, roads, sidewalks, et cetera, but it's one of the best tree-lined cities that I've ever had a benefit of going to. And it's also laid out on a grid. This slide here, slide 11, the roads are laid out perfectly for an objective survey. In this case, we did a block-by-block survey of environmental conditions. In fact, you know, this map here shows what we did in 2008. And as I mentioned earlier, there was 20 years of previous experience at this site, and there was little areas that showed maybe this is a plume or maybe this has a higher concentration, and those results were contoured based on, you know, limited groundwater sampling or some even some soil gas sampling. But what we decided to do is just basically take the downtown area and then basically subscribe that red dashed line around about 50 or so blocks of the city and just said, okay, we're going to start way down north by Cypress Creek. Okay, and that's, if you look from the left of the top of your slide, there's the Alabama River, and then there's a tributary to that called Cypress Creek, and it flows from the right of your slide to the left. Those are probably the two largest groundwater discharge points for any of the groundwater. You can see the groundwater flow direction is smack dab in the middle. It's an arrow flowing from higher topographic altitudes to the bottom of the slide, and it's flowing north to those lows. And the one slide that Rusty already mentioned, or the one location on the slide Rusty already mentioned, was at block 30 and 31. That's where the original exposure to the workers was occurred. And then if you go north towards the river, you can see the water treatment plant. And then thinking back to the first table we showed, that's well 9W and 9E. Those were both the shallow public supply wells that had the PCE in them. So, again, not knowing much about what had happened specifically at this site, we decided, as far as source areas, we decided to take this objective approach. We numbered the blocks. We tried to stay within the hydrologic boundaries imposed by some of the subsurface stratigraphy based on the old terraces as the Alabama River had cut down. And it basically led to this red hatched line, which is sort of a bowl of groundwater, and groundwater is falling from the bottom of the page to the top. And the other thing, too, is that we had this objective approach, and as Rusty mentioned, we couldn't just go in there and bring big drill rigs and do a lot of high visibility destructive approaches. We wanted to go in there because it was a capital city. We wanted to be sensitive to the fact that the city fathers were undergoing significant revitalization attempts, and there's multiple historic landmarks within the city that we had to be sensitive to. So we were basically limited to minimally evasive approaches. We had to be objective. So what we decided, again, going back to that first slide with the great density of trees, we decided to do a tree core survey, starting down there by block one and finishing up there by the Capitol, which is in your lower right-hand corner. And we did this survey. It took us about a week and about four people to do it. And the other thing I want to mention before we go off the slide, we did not stop our survey where the last bit of evidence suggested that the contamination was limited to just where that building was on blocks 30 and 31. We decided to, again, be objective and move uphill. Let's advance to slide 12. Perhaps some of you are already familiar with why we would do a tree core survey. If you are, this will just be review, and if not, hopefully this will be something you can use in your toolbox. Basically, trees are like us. They need water. They take up water. They take up soil, gas, and air from the subsurface and any of the contamination that's associated with either of those media. And although we could sample the roots, it's much easier because they're all funneled back to a trunk. And if you core or take a biopsy of the tree, you get an integrated time-averaged sample of what that tree is interacting with at depth. Okay, the next slide is slide 13. This is not just sort of a jury rig type of method. It's actually a peer review method. One of our co-authors who participated in our 2008 study is Dr. Don Verbluski. He invented this approach and was kind enough to join us. We were the ones who collected the cores according to his method, and then we would send the cores back to him to be analyzed in the field, and I'll show you how we did that here in a minute. But there is a user's guide. You can go to the USGS webpage and just type in user's guide and tree cores. You'll find it. Please download it. And then it's also an approach that's gotten out into peer-reviewed journals with high-impact factors like Environmental Science and Technology, as shown on the right. So it is something you have credibility if you propose to do this at your site. So how do you do this? It's very simple. You go to your tree. In this particular case, like I said, there's a lot of percent impervious area in this particular urban area. This is a great example on slide 14. It looks like a tree growing in a pot, and many of the trees are like this. Obviously, the little bit of green you see around the trunk of the tree suggests that these roots of these bigger trees are going straight down to the water table, or at least straight down through the vegetative zone to near the water table. So it's a great place to look at how that tree could be used to tell something about the subsurface distribution of contamination without even having to have a well there. So what do? You take an increment auger, which is that orange T-looking thing. You go about chest height, and you advance the core into a tree below the bark about 2 inches because you need to get to the xylem tissue where the water is residing and the soil gas. And you take a couple of cores per tree. Usually we collect, according to the user's guide, cores on the southern side of a tree because that tends to be where the solar exposure is, and it tends to be where most of the sap flow is. One thing to keep in mind, and you'll see it if you look at the user's guide, there can be a great deal of variability when you sample a tree core and you're looking for things like chlorinated solvents. And just a couple of take-home messages. One is that if you do detect a contaminant in a tree core, that pretty much means that you have an issue, you have contamination. You don't really know at that particular time if it's groundwater or soil gas, or if the soil gas contamination is derived from the groundwater source. In many cases, you really need to know where the water table is. Typically, if it's a deeper water table and you get a tree that's not a phreatophyte, you know, it's not tapping the groundwater, typically you can then confidently say that what you're seeing in your tree is due to soil gas off the water table. So in many cases, what we're finding is, particularly the farther uphill we go at this site or the farther you get away from the water table, a detection in the tree core suggests you're getting something that's still residing in the unsaturated zone. The other thing, too, is that if you don't get a detection, it does not necessarily mean that there's no contamination at that particular location. But if you get something, there indeed is. Let's advance to slide 15. Well, what do we do with this core once we get it? We immediately place it in. This looks probably familiar to many people who sampled. You place it into a 40-mil VOA vial, and then you put a cap on it. This is a picture showing the core inside the VOA vial, and then almost immediately, because we did this during the hot summer months here in the southeast of August of 2008, you can almost see the condensation. That's the trapped water vapor. It's not a bad photograph. It's just that's the actual condensation. It's really a good visible surrogate for any VOCs that might be in there. Then what we do is we, since the cap has a septa on it, we insert a gas-tight needle through the septa, remove an aliquot of the headspace, and then we shoot it. In the case that we have done, we shoot it almost real-time on a field GC that's in a hotel room that's climate-controlled. That's where Dr. Valesky was. And that sample goes down through the GC, and the chlorinated solvents are speciated and identified with a photoionization detector. The other thing you can do is you can take the same core, hold on to it, send it to a lab, or you know, run it on a GC mass spec back at the lab. So let's go to slide 16. This is a picture sort of without the numbers of the blocks to avoid confusion and without the red ring study area. But this just shows where we were able, these are open circles, where we were able to collect cores from trees. The thing I want to point out here is we collected a couple along the riparian zone of the Alabama River. We collected some along Cypress Creek. We also, since we were down in the creek, we collected because there were no trees growing actually in the physical middle of these streams and creeks, we installed passive diffusion bags. That's what that PDB means. It's basically a surrogate for a tree where you can let VOCs that are discharging to the stream through the hyporheic zone accumulate, and then we sample it the same way. And it's at groundwater detection. It's not a surface water detection, even though we're standing in the surface water when we do it. We're deploying it below in the hyporheic zone. And then as we go uphill, you can see there are some areas that we got near we were able to core trees near the public supply wells. Then there's sort of an area where we couldn't. There were really no trees in these locations, or there were trees, but we did not have permission to core them. As we move farther uphill, like I said, we went past the area, the two gray boxes where the original exposure to the two workers was. We were able to get a good bit of trees there, and then we decided, like I said earlier, to be objective and move uphill. So we've got a good bit of tree cores to the south side of the site. Okay, let's move on to slide 17. Now, here are the results. Basically, wherever there's a color, that means we've got a detection. Okay, TCE in the tree core was yellow. PCE is orange. Combination of both would be yellow and orange. And then we also had TCE and a little bit of DCE at one tree. And then over to the right by the north arrow in the lower right-hand corner, you can see a little bit of where we detected benzene and toluene. Okay. The point of this particular slide, keep in mind, look at the blue groundwater flow direction in the middle. That groundwater that contains PCE and TCE, that would have originally been discharged into the pumping well at the north part of the slide. Since that pumping well has been cut off, that groundwater is discharging to the Cypress Creek and Alabama River. And indeed, what we saw was PCE and TCE all along that, in those samples from the trees and even the bed sediment, the hyporheic zone samples, we found TCE and PCE all along there. We also found TCE and PCE in tree cores near the public supply well 9W. Remember, that's where the PCE was originally detected back in 91. We also, as we move back up near the groundwater flow arrow in the middle, around the two gray boxes, we found TCE and PCE there. That was the site of that original exposure and where known groundwater contamination had occurred. More to the point, and I think the visible result we got here was we also found TCE south of that, uphill, where really there had been no previous evidence to suggest from initial studies that anything would have been up there at all. And we'll like to call that, as we move through this talk, is I call that a result. So we have, at a minimum, we've added something new to the 20-year history of working at that site. We found these things upgrading of where groundwater had been previously mapped to contain these particular contaminants, and that's on well 18. In fact, let's look at slide 19. You haven't really seen, you've heard us talk about the distribution of where the groundwater contamination is. This pink area is showing the groundwater PCE concentration that was done by the City of Montgomery to request of the EPA in 2007. And you can see where, if you look at the concentrations, if you would have been back in 2007, if you see the concentrations in the footprint, you see where the workers may have been exposed at those two gray boxes. You can see why it looks like that's the source, okay? In fact, when we did our tree core, that red circle, the first one to the middle right, we were quite happy when we saw TCE and PCE in that particular tree core because it coincided with the historic exposure at that area, plus the fact that we knew from the 2007 groundwater data that was a source where groundwater had been detected to contain TCE and PCE. Before we move away from this pink shape, I want to stress that this is not just unique to this site, but in many cases when you look at contoured data, you've got to be careful, and this is something that we're trying to stress here, is that that shape is not probably the actual shape. That shape of the plume, the contour, is really highly prescribed by the data density of wells. So it's one of the things that even if you just have well data, if you really want to know where the plume area is, just even doing tree cores, if you looked, for instance, to the right of the pink, sort of the long axis in the direction of flow, we found tree cores to the right about a block and a half that also contained that contaminant. We have no well there, but the point being is that there's probably some relation. And we'll have to wait till the end of the slideshow to probably get you a better picture of what the groundwater plumes really look like, and we'll be further investigated. But these cartoons really just show contours that are limited by the data distribution. So going back to the tree cores, the one red circle that's really a tree core result to the middle right, that made sense. If you look at the bottom, that circle there, we sort of were scratching our head because there had been, unlike the other hits of TC, there was really no evidence to suggest groundwater was contaminated there. So what is going on up there? So let's just show a quick picture. We're now on slide 20. The tree is not actually the one that the orange-shirted gentleman is standing next to. It's actually down that sidewalk down in the back. But you can kind of see from this picture sort of the reason that tree core sort of jumped off as an initial approach here, because we have an active city, not much percent open area, but we have these gray trees. And that tree, both of these trees that you see here, actually there's three of them, they're probably some of the oldest trees that we sample within the city. They're at least 60 years, if not older. So they were a great reservoir for past contaminant exposure information, which we'll get into later. Let's go on to 21. This is now that actual tree 64 that's on the corner, and this is probably the only one we're going to specifically speak to the concentration, but what we measured in that tree core was 68 parts per million by volume of TCE. This was the highest concentration of TCE that Don or myself had ever measured, and we've been to some highly contaminated sites. One thing I want to draw your attention to is just that sort of that drainage thing at the bottom of the picture. We'll talk more about the relevance to that, to the detected TCE in that tree here in a moment. So let's go on to the next slide. Like we said before, that detection of TCE near the groundwater plume that was previously delineated, okay, that's great. It actually helped us to ourselves confirm that what we were doing had some validity at the site. You know, we knew where the contamination was, and guess what? The tree also showed that. Okay. But what about up the hill? What would be the reason that TCE would be in that tree? What the point was is what type of land use or type of waste disposal behavior had actually occurred up there, and was it related to that plume to the north? So let's go on to the next slide. We're now on slide 23. It's one of these things. Sometimes we have to kind of do a humility check where we basically say, we love using GIS, we love using georeference data. But sometimes some of this old information, like in this case, these bird's eye view type maps, are rich in diagnostic information about land uses. And this is one, we looked at a series of maps, but this is one we were able to get that showed land use activity in 1887. That blue arrow is just sort of delineating where that tree was. There's lots and lots of, like at many sites, particularly capital sites, there's lots of overlapping land use history. In this case, Montgomery goes back to at least 1819. Companies have come and gone. Land uses have been moved around. The U.S. EPA also probably did a more thorough investigation using sandborne maps, et cetera, to look at long-term land use histories. But this also shows the ultimate groundwater discharge point, the Alabama River, and right along the shores there where the former wells were located that actually became contaminated. We go to the next slide, that's slide 24. Same sort of view, same bird's eye map, and that arrow is showing where that tree 64 is. Again, these things are just great and should not be great sources of information and should not be overlooked because they're not GIS based. The other thing you get to learn if you're actually doing the work yourself as you move through the city, again, you look at here, there's not much green space, but there are lots of trees. The arrow in the back up on the hill by the church, that's tree 64. We're coming down looking at this plaque on the corner, this really beautiful old building. And when we look at that, we were coring the trees, and we looked at that plaque, and at the time, this really didn't mean anything. If we go to slide 26, I'm not going to belabor it by reading it, but the point here, it tells us about land use. Number one, the date of the origin of the building was 1855. Then there was also a specific land use, in this case a printing operation, that at least occupied the building up to 1941, as is stated here clearly. And then the question became, well, where did that building go? Did the printer, in this particular case, move? Did they cease operations? The land use investigation showed that essentially that particular printer went from that building in 41 and went uphill a block. And so let's go to the next slide. This is now on slide 27. So it started to become apparent, and the place that we were taking that plaque is actually, if you look where tree 64, that's that bottom red circle. The place where that plaque was block north in that blue square, okay? And what we decided to do is overlay the groundwater plume, the pink, that's PCE, with our tree core results, and then known locations of any particular operation that had been involved with printing, specifically because when that building moved up from 1941, up the block right across from tree 64, that was sort of the key that maybe this is something we needed to look at because they operated there from 1941 to 1997, okay? But there are other printers, and that's why we've, not just that particular printer that moved. There are other independent printers around also, and here's the point. They're north, or excuse me, they're south of where that the two gray boxes are showing the building where the workers were exposed. All right, so let's move to the next slide, to slide 28. So this is the second result. This is, again, new information that hadn't really been previously considered. It appears that the detections of PCE and TCE, at least in the tree cores, were associated with former or past locations of printing operations. So let's move on to slide 29. Well, how would printing be related to PCE in the first place, or TCE? You know, what we've identified the land use, but, you know, did they even use these chemicals, and how would they have disposed of them? Let's move on to a general schematic. This is in slide 30. Basically, it's one of the widely used printing operations called offset printing. And really quickly, and if there's anybody who knows more about this than me, I apologize ahead of time, but really simply, it's a chemical reaction where the actual image that is printed never actually touches the paper that upon which is printed. And the paper here is shown as that horizontal line between the bottom two cylinders. And essentially, ink up on the right is mixed on a plate cylinder. And these plate cylinders are made with aluminum or other metals on site typically. And the ink is applied. And these inks, it's important to remember that the ink itself is oil-based. It can have heavy metals in it, you know, cadmium, chromium, rubidium, strontium, to impart different colors or different shades of gray. It's put onto the plate cylinder, mixed with another solution called a fountain solution, with water and usually alcohol. So these things, both the water and the ink, and you can see they would repel each other, are put on the plate cylinder that's transferred to this offset cylinder, which basically is a rubber blanket, which then itself transfers the image to the paper. As you can imagine, this is a messy process. It requires lots of cleaning, and particularly if you know, the main goal of the particular operation is to have a good, clean product, they would have to clean not only the different cylinders, but more specifically, in this case, the blanket cylinder. So what did they clean it with? Well, let's move to slide 31. The blanket wash, this is sort of a David Letterman top 10 blanket wash. This is from the EPA website, one of the reports they did. And PCE, tetrachloroethylene, is number 5, and then not shown on this top 10 is number 11, which is TCE. So these were commonly used, particularly in the 1960s, because up to that point, printers were having to rely on petroleum or alcohol-based washes, which were combustible. They were really not something you'd want to have you know, near you, because they would tend to explode or were harmful to deal with. On the other hand, chlorinated solvents, they're already oxidized, so they can be stored. They don't have the combustibility liability. So many, many printers around the country used and switched to in the 1960s these particular chlorinated solvent type blanket washes. All right, so we get another result here, slide 32, number 3, PC and TC detected in the groundwater, detected in the tree cores near these printing locations, happen to be also used by these printers. Let's move on to slide 33. Well, you know, what happened to these wastes? Okay, and a lot of this was generated prior to the 1980s. So we're talking prior to Clean Water Act, prior to CERCLA, all that the regulations that manage that now. In many cases, what happened, and these are responses specifically taken from the EPA Section 104E request, the wastes were either dumped down drains or washed in machines. And typically, this was something that was a common practice. They were either put in floor sumps, and it wasn't until after, I guess in this particular case, Safety Clean decided this could be an income stream for them, that they actually invented a company to take care of this waste. So let's move on to slide 34. So this was another result. So this is perhaps how what was done in a particular building at a particular location could make it into the environment, into the subsurface. All right. So now we're on slide 35.
Actually, I'm going to stop and see if we want to take a quick break
right.
on slide number 34 for questions. I just want to be sure you're still okay with the question break now.
Sure.
Okay, excellent. So we're going to just take a quick pause on slide number 34 and start working on some of the questions. We do have a number that were submitted electronically, but before I switch to those, I just want to start with the phone line. So if you're on the telephone and you have a question or comment that you'd like to make, you can take yourself off of mute by hitting #6. And feel free to identify either yourself or your organization and either ask your question or make a comment.
And we have this limited to, what, about 5 minutes?
Yes, just a few minutes for now. Okay, so I don't hear anything on the phone lines. I'm going to go through at least a few of the ones that have been submitted electronically, and we will take more time at the end for other questions. So feel free to continue to submit them. If we don't get through them now, we will certainly get to your questions before we end today. The first question, and I've actually had a couple that have come in online, and people are asking if contaminants are bioaccumulating in the trees and skewing the contaminant levels when you did the tree coring. And they want to know if you're correcting or calibrating for that when you're looking at the core analysis.
That's an excellent question. And we really needed to discretize it two ways. First of all, when you look at contaminants like BTEC, so petroleum-type hydrocarbons, MTBE, or you look at solvents like chlorinated solvents in this particular case, PCE or TCE, plants have the capability to obviously pull these into their systems through the transpiration stream or through soil gas, taking up through the roots. But much like we do, they have internal to their cells their own oxidative processes to destroy those contaminants. So when you sample for chlorinated solvents, when you sample for BTEX-type compounds, what you're getting when you sample a tree, meaning you take the core and you shoot it on your GC, you're getting something that's in the water that day, okay? You know, if you go back and you get the same sort of result, you know, a day later, a couple, you know, years later, then you know, number one, the tree is still pulling up water, but it's also there's a contamination source that still remains. But the bottom line is you don't have, these are not like metals where you have bioaccumulation of the organic part. Plants are able to do actually the same processes that the mammalian liver uses to detoxify harmful compounds. They go through different processes to oxidize and to destroy or to compartmentalize these chlorinated solvents. So, there's no bioaccumulation here. Now, on the other hand, metals, and we'll get to this later on, the metals that we've seen in the tree cores, they can bioaccumulate. But they will bioaccumulate typically to the year in the ring that they took that particular compound up in. But we'll mention that later on. But that's a very good question.
Okay. Our next question comes in from Chatsworth, California. They're asking in reference to slide number 19, what do the large red dots indicate?
Okay, slide 19, let's see. Yeah, the two dots are basically just highlighting and drawing your attention to two particular trees that we cored. So the first middle, if you kind of look through it, it's actually a transparent blue or, you know, blue-rimmed red circle, that's drawing your attention to tree 32 core, and that's actually a yellow dot that shows a detection. The point of showing that is that's sort of our validation that what we are doing in the field positively correlated, you know, our tree core hit correlated with what was known to be under the ground at that point. When we moved uphill to the down part of your slide, that circle is showing and highlighting tree 64. Obviously, we had 64 trees all around the city, but these are the two, really, that I just wanted to stress in this presentation.
Okay. Related to that, someone asked if you needed special permission to sample trees on private property. They want to know how large of a hole is left in the tree after you core.
Well, a good question, too, because in many cases, and that helps explain if we stay on slide 19, where there were trees we couldn't sample. And that's why some of the blocks there don't have anything. It's not because we didn't want to, and it would have been great to have it, but we couldn't because either, number one, there was just a sea of concrete or asphalt, or number two, there were trees, but they were privately owned, and we were denied permission, or three, they were trees that the city owned and had just put in or didn't wish to have cored. So we were definitely sensitive and definitely acquiesced to the owner's wishes. whoever the owner was. And as far as the size of the core, if you think back to that slide where we had the VOA vial, we're only talking about, you know, the size of a broken pencil, you know, maybe the size of your pinky finger, so 2 inches at most. And that's really all you want to do, because you're trying to get to the water that's underneath that bark. Now, some trees actually transmit water through the entire thickness, so it doesn't really matter how deep you go, but most trees tend to transpire water right under the bark.
Okay, great. We'll take one more question online and then carry on. Okay. So this last question that we're going to take is asking about the subsurface geology. They want to know if you were concerned or focused on a shallow or superficial aquifer, or they want to have a better idea of the underground picture.
Right. Good question. Most, and this kind of goes back to, it's hard to show well enough information, particularly for the geologists out there, to get a picture. And I've got a kind of a generic map or cross-section down here a little bit later, but basically the altitude of the sediments that were up near where Tree 64 is was the original Cretaceous Age sediments that then the Alabama River had cut down through recently because in response to the lower ocean level. So you're left with this series of terraces. So you have sands, you have a little bit of clays, and you have even some gravels. In fact, down near where the public supply wells, they were actually situated to tap some of those gravels. And that's why they were such good water producers. Unfortunately, that same high hydraulic connectivity sediments that provided good water also kind of was a conduit when the groundwater became contaminated to actually then have that well pump it. But basically, it's your series of floodplain, cut bank type deposits as the Alabama River adjusted to differences in lowered sea level.
Okay, great. So at 1:56 p.m., we're going to return back to the presentation. We left off on slide number 34. And again, you can continue to submit the questions or comments electronically, and we'll hold them in the queue until we take our break at the end of the presentation.
All right. Thanks, Jean. Well, motoring quite long here. Let's go to 35. So we've got this framework here of what might be going on uphill. Near the form, at least in this particular part of the plume, near the former printer location. So how did that behavior, that not only the chemical use, but the behavior of disposal result in contamination of the subsurface of the soil, but also ultimately the groundwater? And basically, you have this hypothesis to test of surface, soil, groundwater pathway. And how can we evaluate that? Let's move to slide 36. One of the first lines of evidence that suggested this land surface through soil to groundwater pathway, ironically, was data that was collected way back in 2000 when EPA did the initial remedial investigation. What I'm showing here in this slide is the two blue arrows are showing two of the most upgradient monitoring wells. Depth to water here is about 55 feet, and yeah, that's in the shallow aquifer. Okay, and these are wells 9S and 10S. Like I said, they were installed in 2000. EPA did it right. They used rotosonic vibrocore methods, okay? They didn't use drilling fluid or hollow stem auger. They brought, you know, beautiful cores to the surface. They broke them open, and then they sniffed the broken face with a handheld VOC monitor to get a result for whatever was emitting from that, at least what could be seen by a PID. And typically the PID only senses, you know, fuels, but if the concentrations are high enough, it can also sense the chlorinated solvents. The weird thing about this was, you know, we weren't involved in 2000. And there was a different remedial project manager, but this data was sitting there in a big three-ring binder. And I know, you know, three big three-ring binders are something that you all don't see enough of when your own work. But sometimes if you mine that data, some of the stuff, particularly in the appendices, is quite useful. In this particular case, in the back of one of the big three-ring binder type reports, lots of data, and it really hadn't been interpreted. In this particular case, it was that infield screening of the sediments as the well was installed. So let's move on to see what that looks like. Here at slide 37, at those two wells, and we're up near tree 64, just looking at this here is showing in the vertical axis depth below land surface at zero, and this is in feet. For those of you who are interested in metric, this would be, you'd have to do the conversion, but yeah, so it's about 55 feet to water. Well 9S is the plot to your left, that's the one that's about within 30 feet of tree 64. So we're talking, again, back uphill. And that water table is only shown for one day. It's obviously fluctuating up and down. Okay, so at that particular location, the thing I want you to see is that the concentration of VOCs recorded in parts per million by that, you know, these are the fresh cores coming out before they put the well in, shows that even back in 2000, something was going on at that location above the water table, okay, compared to, say, 10S. There's something still going on at 10S, but not as strong. So this was sort of a priori evidence back then that something sort of said, hey, maybe tree 64 is not a fluke. There's something in that subsurface. It's been around since the year 2000. Okay, so moving on to 38, it sort of explains why, like I said, that well is sort of to the left of that tree across the sidewalk, not very far away. And remember when I was showing this drain here at the bottom, and we had mentioned that one of the responses when the 104E request was basically there was an incident where, in at least one recorded incident where washing machines were used to clean rags that had been dipped in the blanket cylinder. It was discharged essentially through a sump to the street and perhaps entered, and it may have only been one time, it may not have been, but to get into, in this particular case, a storm drain. And this shot here shows a storm drain that's connected to an area where that washing machine may have been located, and it's right next to this tree. And the other thing I want to mention here, too, is that one thing we've noticed that this site and other sites that have, you know, quite at least 100 years of history is in many cases the storm and the sewer systems are not necessarily separate, okay? In many cases, they can not intentionally be connected. So this is one thing that was really hard to determine. Is it sewer? Is it storm? In particular, in many cases, we look at a storm drain when it hadn't rained and there was still water flowing in it. So that's sort of, I think this is more the rule than the exception in older areas. Well, we wanted to assess this validity of potential, you know, use and release and disposal inside a building, in this case to the right side of our tree, and somehow entrance into one of the subsurface pipes to perhaps get into the subsurface here and then move down through the soil to have given us that, those peaks, those profiles of high VOCs before you even got to the water table. So we wanted to do a little bit more data at that particular location to verify that. So what we did, these, again, common technologies, tree 64 is right. We're now on slide 39. Tree 64 is right next to the geoprobe, right above the fellow in the yellow shirt. I've got it labeled. And what we wanted to do is not install another well, but we wanted to install a series of what we call dry wells using our track-mounted geoprobe. And this was done last summer. And we, instead of installing well screens to sample water, we installed vapor implants, which I'll show you a picture here in a minute. They sample air under the ground. And rather than install all, in this case, we wanted one every 10 feet vertically, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, we didn't install them in one big bundle because then you have problems of cross-contamination. We actually installed each one separate. In fact, you can see the first two we installed, the upper casing coming out of the ground, and then the two nylon tubes coming out. So, you know, we tried to do this, and everything was bentonite sealed, so when we got a result from a particular depth, we could plot it as such. And if you move to slide 40, that's what a vapor implant looks like. This is a GeoProbe product. It's not something that we just kind of threw together. If you've used a GeoProbe, it's always nice to have something that fits with the GeoProbe, or if you use some other type of equipment, it's nice to have something that works well with it. And it's only open at that 12-inch depth of installation, and then it's continued on up to the surface with the pipe. If we move to 41, we did the same sort of thing that the EPA did in 2000. We used a handheld PID. Probably most of you have seen, either used this or have seen it used before. We've connected it in this case even before we did any of the pushes with the GeoProbe. This is just with a Henry push point type sampler. And we're getting a result here of 1.9. That's in part per million. I know it's a little bit hard to see, but typically the area in that general area, we're getting, you know, low to zero. But this was only at the first couple inches of soil, so we hadn't even gone down very deep, and we're already getting a, you know, part per million type of result. So something was going on there to start to confirm that why 364 had such high TCE. Now, let's go to slide 42. Now, the PID is sort of a general presence or absence. And one thing, if you haven't used this before, it's really a cool infield real-time technique. It's called the color tech. It's based on a Draeger tube where you have a yellow reactant surface that when you pump air through just with a hand syringe, and so you'll be going from the left of this slide to the right through like a lead catalyst, and then what it does, based on the concentration, in this case it is not just a general, it's actually PCE and TCE, you know, you can take your air sample, pull it through this tube, and within just a couple of seconds know what you've got in this particular case. This is a combined detection for PCE and TCE, and the result here is 12 parts per million. This was taken from the installation of the 40-foot vapor implant back in 2011. One thing I want to make sure, too, is that, you know, just our standard federal disclaimer is that any use of trade, product, or firm names is for descriptive purposes only and does not imply endorsement by the USGS government. For the U.S. government, you probably know I read that, but I have to throw that out because we're mentioning a lot of trade names here. So it's more for just telling you what we're doing, not that that's how you should do it. All right, so what did all this implant work reveal? Let's move on to slide 43. There's a couple of different things to look at here. The first is good old 364. That data, the TreeCore data, was taken in 2008. That shows that high level. All right, and then the well there on the far left, it's screened down to from 55 to about 70 feet. The TCE concentration, we started to measure in 2009. We actually got hits on TCE, and we'll see later how that continued to be observed up to the most recent sampling of groundwater in 2011. So we have the tree core up top, we have the groundwater at the bottom, and then within between there in the unsaturated zone, our vapor implant results, and this is just the PID results, this is just the color tech results for TCE and PCE. You can see the shallowest implant at 10 feet had a zero result, but as we got deeper and deeper, you can see where that 40 foot showed the 12, which we just showed previous slide. So there's quite a robust concentration of PCE, TCE in that particular thickness of unsaturated zone. It seems to be related to the presence beneath the road of this subsurface piping at about 10 feet below grade. Okay. So basically the idea here is we went back in just a couple of months ago after everything had settled down from the installation of last year, and we did sort of the same thing. We did our color tech sampling, and basically the situation hadn't changed. There's a little bit of fluctuation of concentrations, but we're seeing the same diagnostic thing. In fact, even though that those are good methods to use, we kind of stepped it up a bit, and the last time we were there, in this case February 28 of this year, we added Gorzorbers, which you may or may not be familiar with, but they're basically universal samplers you can place either in a well or in a crawl space inside a building, or in this case in a vapor implant. And it permits vapors of, in this case, TCE or PCE to move through the sampler and retained on a charcoal absorbent, and then you remove it and you send it to the lab. So we haven't shown this data here, but it does confirm what we see in this particular with the color tech data. All right, so if we go to slide 45, you know, we're kind of connecting the dots. From the groundwater to the tree, we've now connected the dots with the vertical presence of these solvents from the 20-foot to the 50-foot sampler. Well, how do they get down there? You know, maybe does this pipe really have a major role in this particular migration of the contaminant from possible use to the right of the slide to the groundwater contamination here and down gradient? Keep in mind that what we learned from the 104E response is things were dumped down sinks, disposed of down sinks, but you would also expect sinks to not just receive contamination, but also receive, you know, other just normal municipal-type water, tap water, wastewater, et cetera. And that water since the 1960s would have been treated with chlorine. So would form disinfection type byproducts. So the question then becomes, could we use that chlorine or could we use the chloroform as a recent tracer from at least the 1960s to basically connect the dot further to this pipe? So could it be a recent tracer of the pathway for past contaminant disposal? Well, if you look at this map, this is a plot on slide 46 of the distribution of chloroform, which is the most recalcitrant of all the disinfection byproducts. The other ones may have degraded. It wouldn't remain because it's, like I said earlier, this is an oxic-type subsurface. So we looked at the chloroform, and indeed, the chloroform at the well right adjacent to 364, which is right adjacent to one of the former printing locations, down to where the groundwater was contaminated, including down in well one, which the darker purple shape, that actually had our highest concentration, and that was greater than 35 parts per billion chloroform. In fact, you know, most groundwater has either immeasurable or very low concentrations. So to find anything above essentially detection suggests you have some environmental impact. You have some mixing, in this case, from water that had been municipally treated, distributed through the city, you know, flushed down whatever sinks, what have you, into the pipes, and then leaked through the pipes and gotten down through, in many cases, 50, 60 feet of unsaturated zone to the water table. So this was instructive. If we go to 47, and this is sort of a repeat of what I just said. The other thing was MW1S, the well that's near where the exposure to the workers had occurred, also had basically a buffered pH, very typical of treated municipal water, 7.3. All the other wells had fairly acidic, you know, definitely sub-neutral type water. In fact, the concentration we measured in that well in the groundwater was essentially the same level of chloroform reported by the city for the past couple of years of being present in their treated water. All right, so if we move on to slide 48, how did that treated municipal water get to the water table? Okay, and just following the path of least resistance, if things, the treated water, waste, what have you, are being put into a disposal through a sewer, the sewer, let's go to the next slide, 49. In this particular case, I'm going to stress that this sewer pipe is not from this particular site. It's not even from this particular state. It's from South Carolina, a work we did over here at a military base. But the point is the same. Most of these older systems, terracotta pipes, short sections, you know, there's no gaskets connecting pipes. They settle, they break, roots get in, in fact, create their own cracks, as you can see at the top right of the slide. And you have the chance for standing water to leak, et cetera. So this could be one of the reasons to connect the disposal, explain the chloroform hits, and explain the subsequent or even preceding solvent contamination. All right, so slide 50, this is sort of our so what slide. Basically, that chloroform is sort of a tracer that's currently seen, even, for instance, if the TCEPC disposal behavior, you know, had stopped 20 years ago. So it's sort of a nice surrogate to show us a tracer that, you know, this not only had existed in the past, but presently continues to exist, okay? The other thing, too, is that based on the level of contaminants that we see in downgrading areas, both along the river and the trees there in the hyporheic zone at the public supply well, even though chloroform was only added from the 1960s until today, the actual release to get PC and TC all the way down suggests that we are seeing evidence of the release that would have been at least as early as 1940, even though the chloroform at that time was not present. All right, so let's move to slide 51. What we try to do here is just in general overlay the sanitary sewer system on top of where our chloroform was, just to see if there is a relation from what we knew about where the sewer system was. And we're not even talking here about stormwater pipes. But the point here is that the highest probability for leaks, even though they could occur along any section of the pipe, from just showing you that rough picture as an example, would be where you have a triple junction, where you have, for instance, three pipes coming into one junction box. And the other thing, too, here is that the pipes don't have to go all the way north, in this case, across different streets to get above where groundwater has been contaminated, because the groundwater is going to flow vertically downward, but it's also going to flow at an angle. So you don't have to have the leak right on top of where groundwater is contaminated. And I'll show a cartoon later that'll better depict that, what I'm trying to say. All right, so we've got a lot of things that we're talking about. We've got potential locations for sources. We've got potential pathways. What about the timing? And we're sort of heading here on the downside of our presentation today. And, you know, we already did sort of a land use. The EPA did a land use that would suggest what businesses operated where and more to the point when and maybe when they started and when they stopped. And we have the chloroform. It's sort of a surrogate for 1960s behavior to the present. But what about other things that perhaps older water would be there, as suggested by the migration down to the supply well? So what we did is we sampled for chlorofluorocarbons in the groundwater. We sampled for sulfur hexafluoride in groundwater. And we also did a little bit of more specific tree coring, not so much to look at the VOCs, but to look at some of the residual chlorine that may have been left over as we talked about earlier during the question and answer, may have been left over as the tree was degrading inside itself, degrading the chlorinated solvents, but leaving behind the chloride. CFCs are very useful in dating groundwater. Basically, CFCs were not present before 1940, so if we went and sampled this site or any site around the world, you'd never find it. So it's a nice surrogate for groundwater that's entered the system from 1940 on. We go to the next slide. The reason we know this, so we're on slide 54, is other folks have measured, I guess for whatever reason that they had to, they measured CFC concentrations in the air since they were produced. So here we've got a x-axis that shows basically time in the past, and we've got a y-axis showing the CFC concentrations in the atmosphere. And you can see where they started in 1940, so basically you don't have much in the air. They ramp up production until they basically ceased production in 2008. So this is the atmospheric curve. And without really getting into all the complicated analytics, basically, if you measure a groundwater sample and it's got CFCs in it, that CFC concentration, unless things have caused it to change through advection, adsorption, or biodegradation, which at this particular site is very low probability because it's oxic, and there's very little organic matter to absorb it. Basically, you can, from the concentration of CFCs in your groundwater sample, you can determine what that concentration in the air should have been to provide that concentration now in your groundwater sample that's no longer rain, it's no longer infiltration, it's now recharge that's then moved. So you back calculate essentially through Henry's law to determine when your sample entered the ground. That's sort of its born on date or its year of recharge. And the other thing that's nice about this is you get three different, they're not isomers, but three different specific organic compounds when you actually run the sample. So you have the ability to cross-check your result for your age date. Well, what did we see? So we're on slide 55. One thing we noticed that CFCs were only present in the shallow wells. And shallow, I mean the screens were no deeper than about 70 feet. So we're talking about 20 feet of saturated thickness. The deeper wells, really intermediate aquifer wells, could be as deep as 150 feet to even deeper than that. So we didn't see them in the deep wells. So that sort of makes sense hydrologically. They're also not present in all wells. Okay, and one thing we noticed, too, is we're in an urban area, lots of, you know, 100 years or so of history. CFCs can be produced in situ by other businesses. In fact, some CFCs were actually used as solvents by many industries, including the printing industry. If the CFC concentration that we detect in the groundwater sample at the USGS lab that does this work, if it's higher than what would have been in the air at that particular time, it's basically considered contaminated, and we don't do an age date. In fact, if you want to look at this issue in specific, you can go to our USGS website, check out fact sheet that's listed there, and it'll give you all the data you need to know. Okay, so we couldn't use those contaminated CFCs, even though they are present, we couldn't use them to age date the water, okay? And the point here is if we go to the next slide, we're really trying to see this idea, this connection between land surface and the groundwater system. And if we look at the data in slide 57, We're overlaying it just to get you oriented. That purple plume is the wells in the plot showing the chloroform concentrations. So we're looking at water from at least no older than the 60s up until present. And the red number you see right by the blue groundwater arrow, that's the only shallow well where we got a non-contaminated from site area. We got a good enough data that we could say, okay, that groundwater was probably recharged in the late 1960s. All the other shallow wells were contaminated. Now, the deeper wells are shown, the dates there are shown in black, okay? And it's really, you see the progression of groundwater flow from the south to the north, from the high altitudes, the bottom of the slide, toward the river. And you can see just kind of going up the slide from the bottom to the top, you can see older groundwater in that deeper wells or the intermediate wells from 1960s, 1950s, 1940s as it moves towards the discharge point in the creeks. Well, because we had so few shallow wells that we could use that weren't contaminated by source-specific CFC sources for the city, we were lucky that we sort of anticipated that might happen. And we also sampled during the same sampling event, we sampled for the sulfur hexafluoride, which is in the next slide. This is a little bit more exotic way to sample to H-date groundwater. It's useful in these particular cases. You don't go back as far as chloroform, which is 1940. You don't go back as far as CFCs. You don't go back as far as 1960 with the chloroform. And here you don't, you get to about maybe basically 1970. But the diagnostic is still the same. If you see it, it provides evidence that there's linkage between what was happening at the surface and the groundwater. And mentioning it again, the fact that this is a city, very few percent impervious surface, most of that is coming through, most of the water that would be recharged now would be through leaks in these subsurface pipes, et cetera. All right, so what did the data show? Slide 59, same starting point. There's the chloroform plume. The red dots are showing the shallow wells, and the black dates are showing the deeper wells. There's some overlap with the deeper wells, and as far as what we found earlier. The other thing here is that this is really stressing the fact that we're still seeing this recent leakage, this recent indication that this is still a fairly ongoing process, ongoing pathway. And the one thing I want to mention here, too, is these are, it's hard to take this data and think that there's no mixing going on. So what we're really seeing is possibly the youngest age date rather than the complete age date, because some of this water would be mixing with older water. But the point is, it really shows the significant interaction at, 50 feet down of this recent leakage. All right. The last thing we've talked about as far as dating when these things were released is not using tree cores to look at VOCs, but using tree cores in a dendrochronologic sense. I think it's pretty intuitive that tree cores, if you go deep into a tree, you're going back in time, okay? And trees are preserving, as the slide shows, a record of their past events. Some trees, if they have a wide ring, means they probably had a lot of sun or a lot of water. Conversely, a narrow ring, less water or less exposure to sunlight. We as environmental scientists can use that and actually discretize the different rings, as we try to show here, and then actually analyze not just the width, but what the tree actually took up that particular year. Okay, in this particular case, we would take this tree core and we would send it to a lab, and they would look at what heavy metals were in the tree at particular growth rings using a device called PIXI, and it's short for proton-induced X-ray emission. Now, we were primarily interested in that chloride. Remember, that's sort of the leftover of any TC that had been used by the tree in the past, because we can't see the organic part because that's already been degraded by the tree, but the chloride would persist. But we're also looking at other levels of trace elements that might have been related to the different land uses, including chromium, cadmium, rubidium. All of these are relating back to, at least in looking at the hypothesis of the printing operations in terms of inks, plate manufacture, et cetera. As I've already mentioned on slide 61, we're really looking for the inorganics, particularly the chloride from the PCE. The one thing I want to stress, and others have noticed this too, is that some trees, but not all, can move some, but not all, inorganics between rings, particularly iron. It's one of the reasons when you cut down a tree, a lot of times trees will have a redder inside than the outside. It's because the trees are taking up iron and they're pushing it into their center dead xylem to build up support. So some compounds we don't even want to look at because they do what we call translocate across years. Here's a slightly different image. If you look at slide 62, what we're showing here is the tree core results, some of them from earlier. These are the ones that just had PC or TC in them. And I want to show, so we went back and we cored these trees only that we knew had been exposed currently to these compounds. And we wanted to see had they been exposed to those in the past. So I'm going to show you only two results. These are the yellow two circles. Next. Well, before I show that, here's kind of what we would do. We take the tree cores a lot longer. So if the person who asked that question, these would actually be as deep as you can get, rather than just underneath the bark. We shave off a flat side, and that flat side is what's going to be shot with the X-ray. And this is just these two yellow, and it's time on the bottom, kind of like the CFC-type plot, and then chloride concentration and part per million is the X-axis. And it appears on these two trees, at least, that you have some sort of a abundance of exposure to these things, particularly chloride, between the 1960s and the 1980s at those two locations. And these are the same times as we go back to look at the history of use of TC and PC, particularly by industries, including printers, that that's when they tended to ramp up around the country on using these. All right. So we kind of focused on this this pathway. We've now kind of got an age potential release history. Can we go farther up from just groundwater, soil, to pipes, actually back to this potential source material actually inside where this former printing operation was? So what we did in the Tree 64, I'm actually on slide 66. Tree 64 is delineated to the left of your slide. That's also where we did that GeoProbe work, and the former printing operation from 1941 to 1997 was in this beautiful building here, and we were able to get inside the building to do an air quality survey, not a vapor intrusion assessment, but an air quality survey, just like we would do out in the city blocks. And we were able to use, on slide 67, two different approaches. You may have been familiar with these with your own work. So again, this is sort of a review for you. We used the Gore-Zerber method in the building in 2011 only, and then we just completed a comparison just a couple of months ago where we went to the same locations and used the Gore, as shown in this picture, as well as a Summa canister. And these are standard type methods we look at. In this particular case, the regulator on this, right in the middle, that gauge is set to sample only for 24 hours. Okay, so we deploy and remove these samplers at the same time. If we look at the results from the 2011 sampling, so now we're on slide 68. Just to reference us here, gets oriented tree 64 is to the upper right. That's the one that had TCE in it. That's also where the vapor implants show TCE and PC underground, and the water table there also had TCE in it. And then the inside samples are near the former press area. So move over to the left. Those are the inside samples, and the former press is that kind of that darker rectangular shape pointing up and down. And these inside air samples also had detection for PC. That's the black circles with the red number. And those units there are in micrograms per meter cubed, so very similar to what you get from a Summa canister type sample. We also noticed PC and TC using the Gore samplers only outside of the building. That's the red circles. There's just a few of them here. Then there was one single sub-slab that we did, which is sort of in the middle of the image to the left of the blue arrow, showing where the direction of groundwater flow down toward the river. And we were actually able to get through about 10 inches of concrete and find PCE and TC beneath the subfloor. So this is sort of the, you know, the connecting the dots up from the water table. This was the final thing that, that really had to be done. All right, so let's move down gradient. Okay, we've been focusing so far up gradient because that's where the tree core data showed the highest thing. That's where the initial 2000 initial investigation DEPA did, showed the PID data in the subsurface. We have the implant data, now the air data inside. What about down gradient? All right, let's do the same sort of thing as we did before, looking at slide 70. Remember before we were looking at the vapor that was detected in the cores removed during well installation in 2000. What I show here is the same sort of thing. The plume is the 2007 data, actually, of PC in groundwater. So now we've got two wells denoted by the two blue arrows. That's 4S and 1S, both sort of in the quote-unquote hot spot of the groundwater contamination area. Both also show areas where the trees had TCE and PCE. Well, let's look at what the soil vapors were from the rotosonic wells back in 2000. All right, this is what it looks like. 4S is on the right and 1S is on the left. The water table is shown averages a blue line. So converse to the PID data from the two wells uphill, particularly near tree 64, that well 9S, where we saw detectable VOCs from land surface down to the water table, here it's really not evident. We don't see any evidence, particularly at well 1 and well 4, that are highly, not highly contaminated, but contaminated with groundwater that has TC and PC in it. We don't see any residual material in the unsaturated zone. In fact, if we look at 1S, that's very near where the workers were exposed, and the high VOC hits were basically confirmed here. And this was 7 years after the workers were exposed in 1993. So this is 2000 data, and it shows a increase bracketing around 25 feet where the workers were exposed. They weren't exposed to anything as they were moving down to 20 feet. So what this really suggests, in fact, probably what was going on is that the water table in the past was a lot higher, and the groundwater contamination rose up into the then unsaturated sediments and left behind groundwater contamination as residual material as the water table dropped. And that's probably what caused that exposure at 25 feet. So the point here is the groundwater contaminated is not coming from the land surface down. It's coming from up gradient. All right, so let's kind of on a downhill glide ourselves here as far as the slides show. 72, these are sort of the five results that I think we were able to definitively provide from 2008 to at least 2010 at the site. If we all wrap up this verbiage into a picture, like I said, a cartoon, this is slide 73. This is that 2000 EPA initial remedial investigation data. And we're looking to the left, the lower altitudes would be down near the creek and the river. The high right would be up near where tree 64 was. And then this is showing the water table, which is the blue line. Obviously, as you go farther to the right up altitude, you get a deeper, thicker, unsaturated zone. And I've overlaid on top of that the PID results from this is just simply when the wells were installed. And it really suggests strongly the idea that on the right you have the entry point of the TCPC, you have a higher hits in the soil gas, and then you move farther down as the groundwater is recharging. You don't see that in the other PIDs, but it tends to be not only in the shallow system, but if you look in the middle, some of these detections were evident even in a deeper intermediate aquifer, almost 150 feet down. And that shouldn't be surprising for those who have dealt in the past with things like PCE or TCE because they are dean apples and they will tend to sink, particularly if released as a neat phase. So even today, again, this is 2000 data from soil gas, PID-type work, even today we're seeing in one of the intermediate wells, 150 feet down, we're seeing above MCL levels of PCE. All right. We've talked a lot about tree core, soil gas, vapor implants, et cetera. What about the groundwater data? We initially showed what the city had done for the EPA back in 2007. We primarily discussed mostly how the artifact of fewer wells kind of gives you a certain plume dimension. One thing we did is we sampled the wells in 2009, and then the EPA Region 4 Science and Ecosystem Support Division did sampling in 2010 and 2011. So I'm just going to quickly go through those results. Here's the data that when we arrived at the site, this is what the PCE plume looked like in 2007. So we're now on slide 75. We go to slide 76. This is the data for PCE in groundwater in 2009. A couple things here. The highest PCE concentration in 2009 was nearest to supply well 9, the one that was originally detected back in 91, and presumably had it at least decades earlier than that, down near Cypress Creek. It must be kept in mind, and I really want to stress this point, that just because you have a higher concentration in a downgrade in area does not mean that that's where the contamination was released. You know, the footprint of the source does not necessarily coincide with the highest concentration. Particularly here where you have a long potential release history, you have groundwater flow towards the river, and you also have a well that had pumped. Okay? So the highest concentration does not mean you're near a source. And especially when the well was pumping, it would have accelerated the flow of these materials towards itself. All right, so then the EPA went in and sampled in 2010. This is the 2010 image. Again, I apologize because the shape is really highly constrained by the lack of lateral wells. The point to keep re-stressing here is that the higher concentrations are down near the old well in areas where the soil gas vertical evidence above the water table does not suggest a point source downward. And then in slide 78, we've got the most recent sampling the EPA did for 2011. The TCE data sort of tells the same story. This is what we sampled in 2009, and then the EPA did sampling in 2010. So now we're on slide 80, and then finally slide 81. This is what the TCE concentration in groundwater looked like in just last year. And I'll sort of, you know, we've really been hinged on this one particular potential source at the bottom of this slide, the two former printing locations. I'll hint on a little bit extra potential source investigations that are being done to help explain the more widespread distribution of the groundwater plume here in a minute. But to sort of recap, again, using unfortunately a cartoon, this is sort of how you can take all these different forms of approaches, these forms of data, both currently done and also had been done in the past, where you can actually answer these, you know, how, where, and when type of systems. And basically, you've got, you know, two cartoons here that show how you can get groundwater down gradient to be contaminated without any soil contamination above it, but have the obverse up gradient. And then finally, I think these are the last two slides that I've got here, is we focused, this is a hypothetical distribution of PCE in groundwater. This is not measured because in most cases there's no wells to the, basically in the middle of this particular plot. So this is a hypothetical distribution of PCE only in groundwater. However, it's hypothetical in the sense that in some of the areas we don't have a well. We're going to rectify that by installing wells in the future. But the point is, if you look, the lateral extent from the Alabama River down at the toe of the plume up to the right corner of this slide, those distributions of where the plumes would finally distribute themselves are based on raw data. They're based on the detections of PCE in the creek, detections of PCE and TCE in the hyperrheic zone, the riparian trees record, and then, you know, just a simple groundwater flow net analysis. And we focus primarily on, this is the PCE data from 09, and this is the TCE. Same sort of situation. Same sort of situation, but for TCE showing, what we've been focused on mostly is that plume, the hypothetical plume to the left, that kind of the pink plume. But in order to explain all the hits of PCE and TCE in the trees, in some of the groundwater, and also the surface water, there quite probably has to be a separate source to explain all this distribution that is sort of hypothetically situated back to some of these other printers that have been in operation. So these types of data gaps are going to exist no matter, you know, how much work you do. But each step reveals the need to do more work to fill in the gaps. And this is one of the things that I think is not common to this site, or unique to this site, maybe common with other sites. So here in conclusion for what I have to say is basically these are just a small list of what was done or could be done, you know, at our site or could be done at other similar sites that are presenting problems around the country. Tree cores, geoprobing. There's also the ability to use geophysics, both ground and downhole type methods, use vapor implants, the PID, the ColorTech method. You can use chloroform and all these other in-situ dissolved phase groundwater constituents that can be measured. And then finally, the dendrochronology with some of these more recent air sampling type things. So this is all can be done by, you know, the USGS. And one thing I want to stress is that if we, whoever you contact in your own state or what have you, you get access to every other USGS employee around the country. And I want to stress that. If we don't know how to do here, ground penetrating radar, it goes off to our geophysics group up in Connecticut. So we'll get you the resource that you need. And I think, Scott, I'm going to leave these last couple slides to you.
Fantastic. Jim, thank you. I had a chance to look at some of the questions here, and some of these questions related to how we can get, you know, how people can get USGS help in their specific jurisdiction. With EPA, it's as easy as entering into an interagency agreement to get that done. It is that's also an approach that's available to states and municipalities. One of the questions that I saw had to do with the fact, you know, is there a payment required? There is in most instances payment requirement, but there is payment required for USGS services. But there are some instances where USGS has the ability through some granting mechanism to work with municipalities and others on coming up with data to meet their needs without compensation. And Jim, do you want to speak a little bit to that?
Yeah, that's a good point. One of the things that's unique about the USGS, not only, like we stressed earlier, we're non-regulatory and non-land liability bureau, we're also a branch of the federal government who is not supported by federal appropriations. So what that means is we have to react specifically to the needs of other federal agencies to meet their science needs. And, yes, to do that work, we are specifically mandated by Congress to work through these IAGs, or with the military, we do MIPRs, to have that work done. Now, Scott did mention, and he's correct, that we do have a little bit of federal money that we're given each year that we can leverage with a state or local entity, that if they have funds to draw upon a problem, in many cases we can offer up the little bit of federal funds we have to meet the federal interest to help solve that problem. But that's part of a case-by-case basis that we would have to get into that. But the option is available.
Okay. And just to add it to what Jim said related to capabilities, he's true in all he said with respect to the fact that if you hire one, you hire all. And it's of great benefit. And a few examples. We're on slide 86 now, going to slide 87. Just a few examples around the country where there's a partnership between EPA and USGS at different sites. For instance, in the same state of Alabama there was an old plating site there where we had to determine if there was some hydraulic connectivity between the site and the spring-fed system, well system there that was a public water system that serviced about 3,000 families there in Vincent. And they brought in a isotope pro from their Nashville, Tennessee office to work on that. And so it's ongoing right now. It's for the federal and state governments. It's particularly easy with respect to the paperwork, which is, you know, always a consideration when you're working through things like this. The interagency agreements, are real easy to activate in the contract world. And for those of you who deal with contracts, I think you would appreciate the simplicity that is afforded through this type of agreement.
I guess the last slide to wrap it up would be slide 88. And as I promised at the beginning, you know, if either we were talking too fast, or if this slideshow won't make sense to you, since there were no notes attached to it, you know, you look at this say a week from now or whatever, rest assured that you can, you know, read about it in this publication. And if you can't write down the web link, just go to usgs.gov and just type in Capital City Plume, and you should get this, and it's just PDF. And feel free to download it.
I'm going to go ahead and take another shot at a question. And hopefully that's not against the rules, Gene, but
no,
I saw it, and I can go ahead and give it out. One of the questions was, is there some boilerplate language for these IAGs to do this? And there is, and we can make some of these IAGs available to whomever has interest.
Okay, great. Excellent. We're on slide number 88. If there's nothing else the presenters need to cover, I can switch over to the questions before we close things out, if you guys are okay with that. We do have a few more that are in the queue, but I want to take a quick break and see if any of our phone participants have a question. So remember, I've globally muted the line. So if you're on the telephone and you'd like to ask a question, please feel free to take yourself off of mute, and you'll have to get out of the global mute by hitting #6. On your telephone, and then you can identify your organization or yourself, and feel free to ask your question. Okay. Well, you guys have done a great job kind of attacking some of the ones that are in the electronic queue. So you've already addressed questions regarding IAGs and if states can ask for help and how they can do that, as well as mentioning that there are boilerplates and templates available. So I'll work with you guys to make sure those are available. There were also references to some people went out and actually found the links for some of the publications that you mentioned. And I wanted to let everybody know we actually have those links available. So when we get to the very last slide, I'll tell you how you can just find a link and download the documents that were referenced as well. But I want to thank the participants who forwarded on the URLs. We have a question that came in from Chatsworth, California, and they ask, was an ASTM Phase 1 study performed on the area? And if you've muted your line, remember to #6 to unmute.
Scott?
Yeah, I was going to say that I'm not familiar. There was a Phase 1 study performed on the area.
Okay.
Yeah, in fact, if you go all the way back, it's to slide 8. When they had the two exposures, the 91 at the well, the 93 at the workers, and then there was in 93, two different months, the state did a phase one and a phase two. If that's what the questioner is asking about,
mm-hmm.
Indeed, yeah, that's documented.
Okay. We also have a question that I think you guys may have answered already, but I'll read it out loud in case you want to reinforce this idea. But there are questions asking about your sample locations, and they specifically call out the area near Columbus and Court Street. I believe it's sort of towards the left side of that diagram. It looked like there were holes in your sampling locations. And I'm not sure. I think it was you had mentioned that there were just concrete areas or places where you couldn't get permission to sample. So if you'd like to comment further.
Yeah, I hope I'm addressing the questioner correctly, but if you pull up slide 16, and I think I tried to mention the fact that, you know, we were blessed with having a very objective grid to which began our study. In fact, you know, even access to the creek and the river was a blessing because we wanted to go where the regional groundwater discharge occurred. However, as we were moving through the city, there just unfortunately were situations where we couldn't gather any tree core data. In fact, you might be thinking ahead here, but this is one of those opportunities where if there's no tree, or if there's a tree but you can't do it, there's no hurt in going back. And actually, this is something we're planning to do, go back to this entire grid in the city and put in those gore absorbers, because you don't need to have a tree for that. So that's one way, again, as I stressed towards the end of my talk, is as you're progressing through data collection, data that becomes more interpretive starts to suggest other avenues where you need additional data. And this is one of those, to go back in to address these data gaps. And that can be as simple as installing soil gas samplers that are passive or installing a well. In both cases, it has to sequentially follow the preceding step. In this case, we couldn't get a tree, let's say, or there was no well. So I hope that answers the question.
Yeah, I think you covered that one. Thank you. We have a question that's also come in from California, and this is a multi-part question. So I'm going to read the first one, and then we'll kind of go through the list. The first question states, the plume does not appear to be defined by ND wells in many locations. The plume seems to be mostly interpolated from single wells. Is that correct?
All right. So let's just look at slide 19. Every plume, be it plumes that we transferred from previous studies to the work that we did or to the work that EPA did, the plume itself is drawn based on the concentrations at the wells and the nearest neighbors. We don't have, just for simplicity's sake, every single concentration shown. But if it is, it's a non-detect, that we show non-detect. So this is a true representation based on the data from groundwater that we collected in 2009 and what the EPA did in 10 and 11 as what the plume looked like given the limited amount of wells. So, yeah, there's no interpolation attempted here. It's just contouring of the raw data.
Okay. Their next question. You said that tree cores, if they show contamination, does not necessarily mean that there is no contamination. I'm going to repeat that.
What I meant to say was if there is no contamination, does it mean that there's no contamination beneath that tree?
Okay.
Yeah, so the absence of contamination does not mean you have a clean environment.
It may mean that
either the tree is dormant or the tree location of your core, in many cases, it may not be in the right spot. That's why we like to take at least two or three per tree. The other thing, too, we've noticed, and this is something you'll see in the user's guide, is that if you go out and sample on a Monday and it rained the previous day, in many cases, the tree is taking up rainwater. So even if there's contamination under there, the tree is now using rainwater. And if rainwater is clear, that's why I tried to stress that just because you get a non-detect doesn't mean that there's nothing beneath the tree, because you have to look at the source of the water.
Okay,
And the hydrology, did it rain or not?
Right. Okay, their next question. If SF6 has natural sources, how is it indicative of post-1970 releases? And again, the question was, if SF6 has natural sources, how is that indicative of a post-1970 release?
Oh, what you're talking there is really an analytic method, how close you can get to the method reporting level. Yes, there are natural sources of chloroform. There are natural sources of even what we considered as man-made, like PCE and TCE. So, yes, there always is going to be, for pretty much whatever contaminant, and one that comes to mind even before that is perchlorate. Perchlorate is something that we make, but it's also something that can be produced naturally. So we're not talking about – the difference here is not whether it's man-made or not. It's at what concentration it can be assessed as, in this case, post-1970. So it's really a concentration-based indication.
Okay. The next question. Excellent. Yeah, these are some great ones. His next question, he asks, what about gravel channels and multiple sewer lines and gravel/sand pack placed around sewers? Were they considered or investigated as preferential pathways?
Well, Scott, did you want to talk about that, or it's something that we wanted to do? It's something that, actually had been done earlier. We weren't part of that, but it was really beyond the scope of what we could do given our access, our limited access to the sewer system, if that provides any insight. So, yeah, we wanted to do it, but it's something that we – it's obviously a potential pathway. It's also a potential remediation location. But getting access first, it's sort of like when you core a tree, you have to ask permission. And in this particular case, you know, we couldn't get access to do that work.
Okay. And the last question from this group asks, why is a hollow stem auger bad? Cores can be advanced ahead of augers. Rotosonic can create heat in some circumstances, so it is not necessarily better. It is more expensive. Aren't or isn't geoprobe cores, MIP, and soil vapor surveys a cheaper alternative?
Well, I guess it depends on what you're trying to do. Obviously, anything, if you're, you know, again, it depends on what you're trying to do. If you're trying to put a hole in the ground to put in a well, just to get water, then even mud rotary would be good. You're not worried about how you do it, what you leave behind. But if you're, in this particular case, trying to find what the sample contains as an environmental impact and not an artifact of what you're actually doing to grab it, then rotosonic, is, even though it's more expensive, tends to be one of the best ways to get a good undisturbed core. And I acknowledge the whole issue about heat and what have you. In GeoProbe, in fact, when we did our vapor implants, we used a macro core device, and that's even good. I guess my point is, you know, when you're doing hollow stem, and we've done a lot of that, it's just the idea that you're turning something in the earth, and in many cases, what you get back, a lot of times the geologist only has, on site, only has the cuttings to look at. So in progression of probably most desirable, the least desirable, particularly if you're trying to do more than just put in a monitoring well, you're trying to get some information, it would probably be, you know, rotosonic, geoprobe, hollow stem, you know, mud, air, rotary. But, you know, those are all personal preferences based on my experience, and it's obviously open to each individual's, number one, data needs, and number two, experience. So I'm not trying to tell that one is less desirable than the other. If somebody else finds it from their experience, it's better for them.
Okay, great. I don't see any other questions in the online queue, and we are coming up right near our desired end time of 3 p.m. Eastern. So I'm going to take a step and let each of our presenters make any closing statements or comments before I provide instructions on how to submit feedback and get confirmation messages and download documents. So let's start first with Jim, and from the USGS. Please feel free to make any closing statements, Dr. Landmeyer.
Yeah, and I want to thank Scott. I want to thank Rusty. I want to thank the EPA for this opportunity. I know with travel restrictions that we all have that, you know, maybe this is not the most desirable way to communicate, but I think it's better than not communicating at all. I think, you know, even if some people's hackles are raised or if somebody learns something new, or I think it's still an important discussion. And the last thing I want to say is that, you know, this is one site. It's just one region and one USGS office. This can be used at other sites, too. This is something that, you know, I want the tech transfer to get out there that, you know, we're using this as a case study, but there's no reason this type of approach can't be used elsewhere.
Okay, great. And let's turn to you, Rusty. Any comments?
Yes, I just wanted to kind of reiterate what Jim just said, that, you know, using these innovative investigative technologies and scientific resources at, you know, places like USGS, any organization can get, you know, a really good comprehensive picture when they're doing a remedial investigation, you know, compared to what we were doing back in 93 when I, you know, first was working on this project. You know, we were kind of had to operate with blinders on because of our limited resources, and you don't have to. You can, you know, you can tap into, you know, a lot of resources. A lot of the stuff's online. It's, information that you can get just, you know, looking it up and reading. It's free just to find out, you know, what technologies are out there and then go from there.
Okay, great. Thank you. And Scott from EPA Region 4.
Oh, well, we just appreciate the opportunity to make this presentation and to highlight the collaborative efforts between the USGS and EPA on solving these tougher issues with the use of good, sound, objective science. So.
Great. Thank you, gentlemen. So with that, I'm going to direct everybody to slide number 89, which is our resources and feedback slide. As I mentioned earlier today, you'll have the opportunity to download a copy of the PowerPoint presentation as well as a number of the documents that were referenced throughout today's presentation. So, for example, the core guide, the tree coring guide is there. The actual report from the CCP site from USGS is also posted. So if you follow that first link to the additional resources page, you can download not only the slides but the other materials that were referenced today. And you'll also see a link to our short feedback form. It takes about 2 minutes to fill it out, and please know that I do read each and every one of the comments that are submitted there. So I would ask that you take a moment to submit your feedback for today's session. If you share the line with multiple people, once you fill out the feedback form, there'll be a link that someone else can actually hop on and fill out their own feedback form. If you're looking to get credit for participating today, while we don't necessarily offer CEUs or PEHs directly through CLUIN, a lot of our participants are able to earn credit for their participation. So if you've saved a copy of your registration or reminder emails, you have a copy of the slides, and then you submit feedback, and when you submit your feedback, check the box to have a confirmation email sent to you. You can actually have an email sent to you for your own records to verify that you did indeed submit feedback after the session concluded. And oftentimes people are able to earn credit for participating with those resources. If you are not at a computer with internet access right now, those links are available on the seminar homepage. So they'll be open and available indefinitely. So you can come back next week and download the resources or submit your feedback at a time that's more convenient for you. I'm going to also ask everybody to move along to slide number 90, which is the final slide, and there are many ways to stay connected with us here at the Technology Innovation and Field Services Division, or the people that run the Cleanup Information Network website. We recently launched a social media campaign, and we are not only on Facebook and Twitter, but also available through LinkedIn. So if you participate, you can find the CLUIN discussion group or pages on either of these social networking sites and use them to kind of stay in touch when we post new training, we provide new web publications, or other events or information sources related to hazardous waste cleanup are made available. So I want to thank everybody who took their time to not only put together today's presentation, but also for all of our participants who took time out of their busy day to sit down and also engage and interact with our presenters. We really appreciated the questions and the dialogue. So again, my thanks to everyone who joined us today, and again, I hope I can hear from you or see you on a future CLUIN seminar. I want to thank everybody, and I hope you enjoy the rest of your afternoon. This will be the formal conclusion for today's CLUIN seminar.